By the time Hazard arrived at the polling place that afternoon, his fate was sealed. About 400 people had voted, and Charlie had bussed in 96 of them. By a margin of 16 votes, the reign of Charles Hazard had come to an abrupt and unexpected end. That evening, 13-year-old Charlie Wilson strode down the street to Hazard's house and announced that he was pleased to report that his black constituents had just ended Hazard's career. "You shouldn't poison any more dogs," he said before leaving. 36 years later, something about the Mujahideen's appeal to stop the Soviet gunships brought back memories of his dog. I started to think to myself, where are all the congressmen who are always talking about humanitarian aid and the human rights activists? Where are they now? In the fall of 1982, the Mujahideen had no congressional champions. In fact, they had no one in any position of power who believed that they had a chance for victory. Wilson had no logical reason to believe that he could help these tribesmen fight a ruthless superpower. But he felt the same rush of anger and clarity that had made it possible for a 13-year-old boy to bring down his dog's murderer. Surrounded by these determined men, Wilson saw a path to honor, if not victory. It began to dawn on me right then and there that I didn't know what was going to happen, but with my rage and their courage, I knew we were going to kill some Russians. Standing by these biblical figures, he realized that Joanne Herring had been right. His whole life had been leading to this moment. This was the place where he could change history. I saw how clearly it could be presented at home. I knew right then we would be able to overcome the liberals' objections to projecting American power, because this was the Red Fucking Army. This was simply an issue of good and evil. Wilson had one final stop on his schedule, the most important of all, a meeting with Zia-ul-Huq. When asked these days about his heroes, Charlie Wilson puts three at the front of the list: Winston Churchill, Abraham Lincoln, and General Zia-ul-Huq. Zia's place on this list is, needless to say, unusual. In 1982, most of Wilson's congressional colleagues saw Zia as a smiling dictator who had hung his predecessor, killed democracy, and was building an Islamic nuclear bomb, and whose Muslim fundamentalism was robbing women of what little equality and dignity they possessed. But none of this alarmed Wilson. He trusted Joanne Herring's instincts, and he knew that if Zia could put up with her flamboyant ways, he was not an inflexible fundamentalist. Wilson was also shrewd enough to realize that Zia was the key to anything that might be done with the Afghans. When he returned from Peshawar and set off that night for dinner with the president, he was eager to meet this man and decide for himself whether they could join forces to up the ante in Afghanistan. General Zia-ul-Huq was a bugler's son, a child of the British Army, and, in his manner, British through and through. He had accumulated great power as Pakistan's military dictator, but he presented himself in a simple, even humble manner. He was waiting on the steps of the old colonial chief of staff's house when Wilson arrived. Up close, Zia did not seem remotely like the ruthless Islamist he was reported to be. He had a mesmerizing aura, and Wilson was immediately charmed by his warm greeting and the absence of any imperial trappings. The congressman hated it when alcohol was not served, but he took the fresh fruit juice that was offered in good cheer. After the predictable exchanges about mutual friends, he found himself speaking with rage about what he had just witnessed. "Zia became very animated and talked about wanting to go fight the Russians himself," Wilson remembers, as if it were yesterday. "He was all fire and passion, pounding the table, saying, 'There is a way. We can win. We can beat them. We've got to all think about nothing but shooting down those helicopters.' I could feel the fire in his belly, and it excited me." This was the first of many meetings to come where these two unlikely allies would sit alone, keeping the U.S. ambassador and other important dinner guests waiting while they plotted the demise of the Russian Empire. Wilson that night talked straight and tough with him about his unconventional plans. "I told Zia that in spite of the opposition, as long as he didn't detonate a bomb or execute any more Bhuttos, I could double or triple the American commitment with a minimum of commotion. He looked at me a long time and said, 'You know I've been promised many things by Americans before.'" Wilson was careful in responding. "Mr. President, I'm a man of many character flaws, but I can promise you one thing. I will never tell you I can do something in Congress that I can't deliver. Zia looked at me and said, That's very important. I believe that. Before Wilson left Zia's residence that night, they embraced and agreed to talk again the following month. Zia was scheduled to meet Ronald Reagan in Washington, but first he would fly to Houston to attend an elaborate dinner that Joanne Herring was organizing in his honor. In the scheme forming in Wilson's mind, he now had almost all the elements in place to go back to Washington to work his appropriations magic. There was just one mystery to be cleared up. What was the CIA's game? Why hadn't they been asking for more sophisticated guns and more money? The White House was behind the program. President Reagan referred to the Afghans as freedom fighters. No one in Congress had any problems giving weapons to these men. So why wasn't the CIA giving them what they needed? Only one person in Pakistan could answer that question, and after seeing Zia, he directed the U.S. Embassy in the name of the Honorable Charles Wilson, member of the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense, to request a meeting with Howard Hart, the CIA's man in Pakistan.